Greetings, everybody. This is a Travel Addict podcast where you can hear candid stories and discussions about business and adventure travel from around the world, with activities such as trekking, diving, camping, driving, cruising, and just plain chilling out somewhere. We talk about lots of experiences in places all over the world, including the grand, the remote, the edgy, the risque, and ones of questionable merit. Education, fulfillment, and wonder enrich our lives. And of all the books in the world, the best stories are found between the pages of a passport. Stay tuned. Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Malcolm Teasdale here, the Travel Addict. And joining me today is Buck Mulligan. And as the name suggests, he is from Ireland, and Northern Ireland specifically. Thanks for joining me. He's on Greenwich Mean Time, so he's 6 hours ahead of me right now, since I'm on Central Standard Time. And Buck is a bit of a traveler. Find out about his troubles and strife over the years, and he's got some good stories to tell here. Well, thanks for joining me, Buck.
Thanks for having me, Malcolm.
All right. Yeah. Anyway, hope the weather's treating you well over there. I know it's been a bit chilly. You know, my sister still lives over there, so she's complaining about
it all the time. Keep me informed.
We'll get into you. I know you just released a book, so we'll get into that a little bit later on. You piqued my interest because I'd never heard this before, because I'm into travel in a big way. That's why I'm a bit of a travel addict. It wasn't what the name I gave myself, by the way. It's what other people gave me. And they thought, obviously, I need counseling with my travels. Addiction, but anyway, that's another story. But yours related in a funny kind of way to drugs in countries. Now, you mentioned you've been to six countries, if I recall, and your book is called Adventures on Drugs, but it's six countries that have drugs that are, now I don't know if these are legal or illegal, by the way, so that's what I'm gonna, you'll have to tell me about this. Now, these drugs are associated with particular types of countries. Now, I know when you went to Colombia, mm-hmm. I get that. But why don't you sort of start off and tell me about your escapades that you felt compelled to go to countries and just to try their drug of choice, so to speak. Go for it. Well,
it was one of these ideas that sort of like just came out of the ether. I was after like a bad breakup, and I was sort of like sitting thinking about things to do. And I came up with this idea, Adventures in Drugland. And I would just go around and just talk about drugs and legalization and regulation and the history and culture and stuff like that there. And maybe meet some cartels or something. It was a vague idea. But then I'd read Dom Jolly's The Dark Tourist, which you might have read, and where he travels to six dark tourist locations. And I thought, well, I could do that. I could travel to six places and try the six drugs associated with those places. So obviously Colombia being the first place to go, because the most obvious, Amsterdam the next most obvious. And they sort of become a little less as you sort of go through the book. Well, no, I suppose you would know all about Ibiza, whereas Americans, it's not so, you know, they don't, not too sure about it. So anybody doesn't know, Ibiza is this holiday island outside of Spain, and a massive, it's basically where dance music was created, and no small part to do to a large amount of ecstasy that a cult happened to leave behind on the island. So to these places, San Francisco for LSD, Stonehenge. I went to Stonehenge for winter solstice and done magic mushrooms. So all fairly interesting experiences. But yeah. And then of course, again, so another major portion of the book is I've spent most of my life as teetotal. I don't drink. I don't take any mind altering substances. And up until that breakup, I hadn't done anything. And I have my first taste of beer at Oktoberfest in Germany. So,
Well, tell me about, intrigued by Colombia. I went to Colombia on business, actually, But I went to Bogota, Medellin, and I've been to Cartagena a couple of times. And I'm just curious, how many years ago did you go to Colombia? Because obviously the drug cartels were pretty big at one time there.
Well, this all took place over 2014, 2015.
Oh, okay. So recent years then, eh?
It had settled down, obviously, at that point. We're still fairly holiday. It was Medellin where I'd spent my last night. And I decided, because the whole time I'd been there, I was in all the same place, Cartagena and Bogota. But I decided, I'm going to do cocaine in Medellin, because that's where Pablo himself is from. Visited his grave, visited the spot that he died at. And I went to it, but I decided to stay out of the touristy areas, which possibly was a mistake, because I stayed in a hostel outside. And they have obviously this very, very serious homelessness problem.
Yeah.
And these people are all, it's such an extreme level of poverty and addicted to whatever drugs that they're on that they almost stop resembling people, and it's hisses and screams and.
Where was that? Is that was in the outskirts of Medellin?
Yes. No, if this was outside the city center.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so apparently, according to the person working in the hostel, it wasn't as bad. At the time that I was there, it was normally much worse. So so I'd imagine like most of the tourists, I had seen the whole time I was in Colombia, I had seen nothing like it.
No, it depends. That's why I asked you about the time frame. I remember going there, it was probably early 2000s. May have been, early 2000, I think. And I went to Bogota. It was a bit edgy then. And I remember cars going to a parking lot, and the police were searching underneath and inside the car with dogs. And I took a picture, and then I got a rifle poked in my ribs by the police. I thought, okay, I didn't mean it. But I had a request by the host there to just travel to Medellin for a couple of meetings. And my first impression of Medellin was, this is a beautiful looking city. But I remember I was there a couple of days, and I remember them saying, well, hey, Malcolm, we'll take you out for dinner tonight and take you to one of the local establishments. I said, that's cool. I always like doing that. But we're halfway through the meal, and he said, just to let you know that there was a shooting here 2 weeks ago, drug-related, part of Escobar's. I thought, well, great. Now I know. So it's funny, when you went to Medellin, I just thought it's calmed down then. But the time I went there, it was a sort of an issue. But
are you sure you're only seven? If you're there like 2000, Escobar had only been dead five, 6 years, something like that. There. So you still, we'll see. A portion of my position on the book ultimately is trying to make an argument for the legalization and regulation. Yeah. Of drugs, and a portion of it is Pablo Escobar was on the Forbes rich list. He was, top 10 richest people on the planet.
Yeah.
And had cocaine been legalized and regulated, and it was selling it to wealthy Westerners. This is where the money was coming from.
Yeah, sure.
And had this market been legalized, regulated, farmers been fit to unionize, all these sorts of things. But to tax cocaine, put your warning sign like we do with cigarettes on the side of it. Pablo Escobar, my assumption is he's always a criminal. My assumption is he always becomes very rich, but he doesn't get on the Forbes list.
Yeah.
He doesn't become this absolute warlord. I mean, I think over the period, America put pressure on the Colombian government to send him in. Is basically Colombia, Pablo says, better to in the ground in Colombia than in prison in America. So he was not going down. And I think over the course of a few years, 5,000 people died. I could be something in around that. So he properly went to war with the Colombian government. And all of this money coming from Western countries, and the Western countries were the ones putting the pressure on to take him out.
Yeah, exactly. But,
So it's now I don't believe that this is a cure-all, it's going to fix every issue, and if legalization and regulation, more issues and problems, new issues and problems come about. but it addresses the reality that's on the ground. The yep. reality is, if you know the right people, you can get drugs now. That's just it. It's just having those right connections, and by playing, pretending that we're going to, you know, shoot the right person or put the right person in prison, we're going to stop that. It's, you know, we need to just get out of that mindset and thinking.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because wherever we live, we get a version of the news, but sometimes when you visit a country, what actually happens there is quite different from what you hear on the news, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost when you visit countries, you know, if you want to go there for a few days to just see the country, and but the government websites say just don't go there for whatever reason, they instill that element of fear into people, and you just, well, you know, and that happened with a trip to Russia recently, and that's what the US government website said, because there was a spat between the two countries at the time. But I went anyway. There's no sign of any issue at all. It was just great. But anyway, you survive that, but Amsterdam came up on your list of places to go to, and I get that. It's pretty open society. Great. I love Amsterdam. It's a great city, isn't it, though?
It's lovely.
Lovely. And it's just cool walking around there. Yeah, I know the cyclists don't like the pedestrians a whole lot.
No, they do not.
It's funny that it's, you know, the abuse by people, or the cyclists, or people just walking across the street. So what happened in Amsterdam then? You just do what locals do?
It was because I mentioned in the book, I'd actually had a joint before I went to Amsterdam. So I thought, well, for the first time I go here, I'll try an edible. And absolute amateur move, I buy one of these space cakes and eat the whole thing in one go. So you can imagine what that experience is like. But it was funny enough, it was like of all of the narcotics I tried, it was easily the worst experience. Like not even close. I mean, like there was like other like fairly extreme experiences, but yeah. the full edible was just absolutely terrible. Oh, you know, yeah. just sitting in your back in the corner trying to make sure nobody can sneak up on you, that sort of idea.
Oh dear! I basically just passed through Amsterdam. We just stayed there a few days, but I found it just stayed by the Leidse Plain. There, it was quite nice, and they got bars there and pubs and a few good Indian restaurants around the area. But just passing through, and I think the Dutch people are very hospitable. You know,
yeah.
They're a friendly bunch of people, and we just love traveling through there whenever we can. And
when I was there, so I was there with the lady. But we went to The Hague. We went Venos, which is absolutely fantastic. Like, it's genuinely, it is like just one of the most, I don't mention it in the book because, you know, there's only so many words I can, but it's a genuinely, like, just around every bit of corner, there's a bit of like either, you know, a 300-year-old building or a bit of like actually nice looking modern art or,
yeah,
it's beautiful, genuinely interesting, the towns and cities. We also went to, forgot its name, but there's a small town outside Amsterdam, which is what Amsterdam used to look like before it became touristy.
Mm-hmm.
And I do mention that name in the book, so you need to buy it to find out.
Wasn't Utrecht, was it?
Utrecht, yes.
Okay.
So I think Utrecht's now becoming more, because it's got the name, oh, this is what it looked like before all the tourists arrived in Amsterdam. So now all the tourists are going to Utrecht.
Yeah.
But no, it's overall, it's a fantastic city. Stayed in hostels, fairly cheap.
It is actually. When you get time, just Google sports in the Netherlands. But there is a sort of theory that the Dutch did invent Kolf, C-O-L-F. Strange. But, you know, you wouldn't put it past the Dutch, would you? Because they're pretty creative.
Yeah, no, it's. I actually mentioned this in the book as well. I mean, this is that they were a proper, just before Britain really took over, the Dutch were a proper industrial, pre-industrial power. Yeah. They had colonies all over the world. New Zealand was a Dutch colony. So Zealand is a province of the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And so New Zealand is, you know, obviously it's one of their colonies. So this was a really progressive modern area of the world. It just sort of gets forgot. Also, you know, New York, originally New York, New Amsterdam. And it's sort of like, so they have this massive history, this huge culture. You mean, like up in the Northern Territories, you have the Delta Project. So this enormous project. So there's an old saying. So a third of the Netherlands has been like reclaimed from the ocean. So they have the Delta Project.
That's right, yeah.
Sure. So they have a saying, the God made the earth, but the Dutch made Netherlands. And so it's, but anybody who says, oh, Amsterdam, Netherlands, to go, oh, prostitutes and weed, you know, like that's the normal go-to stereotype. But it's, I mean, like, it's an incredibly fascinating, very cultured, very historied country. And there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah. And of course, they are, they have territories in all over the Caribbean as well, the ABC Islands and Saba and St. Martin. Well, that's an autonomous country of the Netherlands now, but wonderful places, by the way. Anyway, tell me about Stonehenge. Now, I saw more of Britain after I emigrated to the United States than I did when I was born and raised in Coventry, but growing up just to keep to our own around the area. But I never saw Scotland, for example, when I lived in England. I never saw Stonehenge. But these are sort of places to go to until I moved to the States and went back to visit parents and relatives. Then I went to see them. But I did visit Stonehenge a few years ago, and it's sort of in the middle of nowhere. So tell me about your escapades at Stonehenge there. I forget what you just described as, but solstice. But did you camp there or something? Or what did you do? Is it you there for a certain time of the year?
Yeah, so just to say, I had a similar experience as you're saying. You only started visiting England. Yeah, there's visiting portions of England after you came home. I lived in Australia for a while.
Oh, okay.
And so we're 3 or 4 miles from my house, is right beside my granny's house, is an ancient Irish stone circle.
Yeah.
Now, I'm very interested in that sort of thing. But for years, for 25 years, I never went near it. I never went to visit it until I was living in Australia and came home and went, oh, I'm going to go see that.
No, it's just weird, isn't it?
Yeah, but I know. So solstice, of course, shortest day of the year, 21st of December. You know, a lot of, you know, so you find all these winter festivals in around that time. It's because it's basically been set on top of solstice. So the people who built Stonehenge and then the people who came in after it both seem to have like celebrations and parties here at that time, a massive amount of animal sacrifices and things like that there. So it took off again in the 1960s, 1970s, rise of the hippie movement, you know, the sort of idea of like the Druids and so that the Neo-Druid and Wicca movement started like, again, having music festivals, having parties at Stonehenge. Thatcher's government put that under control and sort of made a real limit of it and stopped people from going in the sort of crowds that they were going in it. But every year now still, the British Druid Society has, that's the name of the term of the organization, has a small ceremony in Stonehenge, 6 o'clock in the morning, on the solstice. But what you'll tend to find is that people camp alongside Stonehenge a couple of days beforehand, so in the road beside the field, basically. So I spent my night by sheer chance. I met someone who knew someone, which I got a lift with a witch to Stonehenge that night. Avebury Stones first. So the biggest stone circles in England are Avebury, who are like a few miles, maybe an hour's drive away from Stonehenge. So I spent my first portion of the night there talking to the locals who didn't want to see me there. It was very much the ceremony.
Where did you physically sleep that night?
Oh, on the side in the field. I did barely sleep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a bit of a camp, bit of wet grass with my jacket underneath my head. So I was just commenting on how my, you know, so it was, I arrived there at 8 o'clock at night. You can imagine what 8 o'clock December night in an English field feels like. But there's a couple of hundred people already there. There's campfire. There's music. I arrive, and it's just dark, and you can hear the drums sounding in somewhere in the distance. You just follow the drums, and you arrive there. I met some guys that had a campfire going. I sat with them. They had caught some pheasant. What was it again? Pheasant and squirrel stew. I had some of that with them. By chance, there's a funny story about how I get the mushrooms. So I'm not getting into it because, you know, I want to leave some mysteries here. But I get my mushrooms, and so whatever, it's 12 o'clock at night. My ass is soaking from sitting in wet grass.
Oh, yeah.
I'm cold. I have a pair of socks over my hand as makeshift gloves, and I just take these things beside the campfire. And it's a fairly interesting experience. I mean, the psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in mushrooms and psychedelics in general, they sort of give you this feeling of like connectiveness to your surroundings and to the universe and
spiritual realm or whatever.
Yeah,
the aliens didn't come back and visit you that night.
No aliens came. Well,
the mushroom, I don't know if that means the mushroom didn't work or whatever. You weren't visited by anything outside my planet then, right?
No, everything was very much earthbound.
Sort of a spiritual adventure almost, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was an interesting, because what it does is I was sitting in front of the fire and I didn't feel anything because I didn't know, had I taken enough, maybe I didn't take too, maybe because I only had a small handful of, like, it was Liberty Cap, so it's like the native mushroom that grows around the area. I had taken some of those and just sort of sat there, and for whatever reason, the fire just started to crack, and I could hear just it was a twig breaking, and it just sort of dawned on me what I was hearing was as the sound of that stick, that piece of wood transforming into different energy. That fire was a visual of that stick becoming heat, becoming sound, becoming light. This is that stick is changing in front of my eyes into this here. And it's a fairly obvious statement, but it's like, but at the time, but again, it is a profound thing that's happening. And maybe you do, because it's a mundane thing, seeing something burn, you don't truly appreciate how genuinely amazing it is. Yeah. This is transforming in front of your face. And then I have this feeling of the connectivity of all the people who have sat at campfires and this around this date beside this monument for millennia. You know, maybe not, maybe some of my ancestors.
Yeah,
you know, it's not that far away.
No.
And we know that people came from Scotland, so it's very possible that the Irish came over as well at some point to sacrifice something, to do something, and have this feeling of just this connectivity of, you know, my ancestors in this place once. And all the things that have to happen, all the small connections, all the small coincidences, the people that I had to meet just to get me sat here right now, and just like, just, it's, and again, at that time in that place, in that particular mindset, it was just, I was just blown away by it. But it was probably my favorite experience.
Oh, yeah.
Just the whole thing. I really like being there. So I had when I first arrived in Salisbury, the first thing I done was I thought, as just a normal tourist, I'll go visit Stonehenge. And I paid my money. I got the bus. I walk up the plastic. There's some plastic lying in the ground to keep your shoes dry. Up some, you know, up to the string that stops you from going to the stones. And I looked at them and I went, "Yeah, seen these before." You know, because it's one of these things you tick off. It's like seeing the Eiffel Tower or seeing any of, you know, you've seen it a million times in every media. And it's like, yeah. Some Japanese girls beside me with a selfie stick. I was like, okay, yeah. And I looked at them for a few minutes, read some of the billboards and went, okay, went home. So whatever, £30 for 5 minutes of staring at some stones. Didn't care. It was just like, okay. But that morning, still dark. And so you know, like, of all, like, so there's people in full druid costume, one guy dressed as as like a, almost like a Christmas tree made out of just random colors of material playing an accordion. You have people in full costume, drums, the whole thing, and probably still some of these chemicals pumping through my brain. And I am just bouncing, standing outside these gates. And then they open them up and we all just, some people sprinted, some people ran, some people just walk steady. Everybody's just going, trying to get the best spot inside the circle before the ceremony started. And when you actually get to go there during the time that it's opened and actually walk up and touch them, they are genuinely stunning. It is, you understand why people think, oh, something otherworldly had to be involved, because they are enormous. And you don't appreciate, when seeing the pictures or whatever, standing close to it, you don't appreciate that. You need to be right underneath these things.
Yeah. I didn't realize there was so much at that place. Like you and myself, we've been to places around the world which you just sense as an awe of importance to it.
Yeah.
You know why? You just sense it. It's, I don't know if you would go through this ceremony again or this this process.
Oh, boy, yeah, at some point. Yeah,
you just don't know. It's something you need to go back to. And I don't know if you've been to the country of Bhutan, but there's a wonderful place there called Tiger's Nest Monastery, which you can actually climb up to. And I did that once. But for whatever reason, I have the urge to do it again. And I wanted to go back this year. It's cut off right now that you can't even get in the country. So whether that actually happens, I'm getting up in Asia. So physically, I should be able to make it there. That was quite a strange, but a fantastic experience. I really want to do it again, you know, just to experience that. So, yeah, you know, keep doing it. You've got to. And I think the more you do this stuff, the more you want to do it. You get a taste of this adventure, if you want, and the more you want to do it. Now, I'm just curious, you know, with the drug aspect of this and the places you've been to, have you ever been to Nepal?
I've never been to Nepal.
Okay. The reason
I've been to Nepal adjacent. I've been to India.
Okay, so it's not that, but yeah, so you've been to India, you might relate to this, but obviously Nepal is, because you get a Kathmandu, it's completely chaotic, by the way, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But if you venture up into the Himalayan mountains, marijuana grows wild up there, and you get people pushing weed around the streets of Kathmandu. I got approached several times, but I don't get into that, but it's illegal. However, the cops, police just turn a blind eye to it.
Yeah.
But if you get in the mountains and where the people are generally happy in this small village, who knows what they get up to recreational-wise, but they seem to be a happy bunch up there. But it's sort of high up in the mountains here. You can do a trek for a couple of days. Wonderful experience. So if you want to add something to the bucket list, that maybe is right up your street. I don't know.
Could be. Maybe if I sell enough copies, I'll do a sequel. Yeah, we'll see.
Like what I say to people is, you know, you're younger than me, Doc, but I've been doing weird stuff for a few years. Even though I've got a bucket list, it's getting longer rather than shorter. So I always say to people, look, if you've got something you want to do, then don't leave it too late. Don't have any when you're on your deathbed and they want to pull the plug. Try and do it the best you can and get it out of your system. Don't have any regrets. And that's me. So last year was a complete waste of time. Hopefully this year is not. So anyway, but those are cool experiences. But as I said, I never thought Stonehenge would be like that. So if that was the best experience, you must have something based on what you've done with these six countries. And what is the next on your list to do, basically?
Well, the next thing I did, so last year, which again was a bit of a bust, was I was meant to travel to Iran. I was meant to... I mean, it was like I was applying for my visa just as COVID was getting like real bad.
Oh.
So I was like there. So I was like, obviously nobody replied to me. Travel wise, I have a million different things I want to do. I want to head to Israel, Palestine, do that there.
Yeah, sure.
Go to Iran, want to go to back to Thailand at some point or another.
Yeah.
The next book I'm actually working on is called All I Care About Is Sex and Violence.
Yeah.
So there's a Muay Thai training camp in Thailand called Tiger Muay Thai. It's in Phuket. So a lot of MMA fighters were there. And I think I spent 6 weeks there once.
Okay.
I'd love to go back and spend another 6 weeks and do an intensive cool training camp. Yeah.
You remind me of you may have heard of this guy. He's Irish also. You ever heard of a gentleman called Mark Zolo?
That sounds very familiar. Mark Zolo, what has he written?
His nickname is a Naughty Nomad.
Oh, right. Yeah, I see that picture here now.
Just check him out on Google him, and he's got plenty of stories to tell. And you have what I would say a similar mindset to him. And he's written books as well. But anyway, just food for thought there. You're also part of, you say, a science and skepticism group called the League of Nerds.
Oh, I was originally. It's stopped a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, no, but no, it's still a portion of what. So the book is travel, and the book is a lot about you know, the drugs and the experience and stuff like that. But then it's also about just sort of the science of the drugs, of culture, and sort of just interesting things that I find along the way. So I just have like a background in just talking about interesting things. And so I've always been interested in science and skepticism. So this has probably helped me come to the positions that I have come to regards narcotics and around there.
I'm just curious about that statement, because you said it said science and skepticism. Are you skeptic about science? Or
No. It's okay. So there's a
skeptic about plenty of other stuff.
Yeah, I know. It's so. It's not skeptical of science. It talks about just sort of like so skepticism from the philosophical standpoint.
Yeah. Okay.
So using that as a tool to understand the world a little better. But yeah, you could just say a science podcast or a skepticism podcast. One of the two. But. Yeah, but and also it's very much a science thing.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm a science type. I'm doing now. Your book, Adventures on Drugs. Are you? Oh, you've just released it, right?
So yeah.
If people want to find that, is it on Amazon or where is it?
It is on Amazon. I think it's on some other online websites. I tell you, I think if you don't want to use Amazon, check the other one, because I think it's the first time ever publishing a book. I use someone called Ingram Sparks, and I think Ingram Spark puts it on to other formats. It's out there.
Yeah, I've heard of Ingram, and even Amazon has the KDP section where it will help you to self-publish that, and it's actually quite well managed here. It's going to be in the UK as well, but even if you want to go that route as well, you know, it's easy to get something published, and it points out errors and all that stuff when you get it inspected, and it's automatic. So it's actually quite a good process, but I'm aware of Ingram. So, well, good luck with that. How long has that book been available, by the way?
3 weeks or something like that there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Then, of course, I don't know how many books are released each week in the marketplace, but one thing is writing a book. You think about this, you know, when we were growing up, my parents were World War II vets, but they kept around. You imagine they were born in 1920. They both have passed away now, but you know, growing up, they had pictures, photographs, black and white pictures, and occasionally videos. But one thing they didn't keep around was words, right? Mm-hmm. I remember the voices, but if they documented something, my mother would say, Malcolm, write a book. Okay, well I did. I've done five, but I've just, one of the things that is good about writing a book, and you'll get benefit from this, I think, is when I get old and senile, I'll be able to open up a book that I wrote and read about things I did and probably think, who is that guy? You know, just because you can. It's like looking at old photographs and looking at old videos. You're sort of reliving something there, but for your own benefit, it's definitely worth doing. And it's a cool thing to do. Yeah, you can mark it by all means, but say you've written a book, it's an achievement in itself. Right?
Yeah.
It's not a 5-minute job.
And way too long.
You're going to do it. But if you turn it into an audible book, well, that's a different matter. Like that's more challenging, but deal with that as
I'm actually actively started that last week, so I've got the first chapter recorded.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, I know
it's challenging, man. I tell you. But anyway, what's the name of your website, by the way?
need to make sure it's up at the moment. I'm getting it put together, but it's buckmulligan.com.
Oh, okay.
And it is, if I can remember correctly, but if anybody wants to contact me, just get me on Twitter at that buck yay.
Yeah, okay.
Twitter. If anybody wants me to do a festival, wants me to do their podcast, wants me to come to their living room and set it, as long as they buy a couple of books, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And pay for lunch.
You never know. Well, every little bit helps, but you know, we this is stuff that you know, we want to do. We're travel people. We like to go off and see how the rest of the world works and live. It's a cool thing to do, and the more you do it, the more you want to do it. And what you've done so far is good, but you've got many years left to do a lot more. And I know you'll be doing it quite often. So
if COVID ever ends,
I'll close this out, Buck. But I just want to say thanks for joining me today. This is sort of inspiring because, you know, it's not often that people travel like you do in the way you do. And yeah. It may sort of spark some interest there. But anyway, thanks again for joining me today. Appreciate that. Good luck with the vaccines coming up and your travels in the future. All right.
Wonderful. Thanks, Malcolm.
Pleasure. Talk to you soon. All right, mate. Take care. Many thanks for joining me today. This is Malcolm Teasdale signing off. Before I do, please check out my website, malcolmjteasdale.com, for more information about my travels around the world. Okay, folks, talk to you later. Bye for now. Stay safe.